Today's show is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, sharing nothing but the best in whole grain nutrition and committed to their mission of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. It is midsummer right now, so hopefully you're seeing a lot of good foods at the farmer's market, maybe picking up some CSAs. And, you know, a term we hear a lot in the food world is the idea of food distance or food miles, you know, how local is your food and, you know, so forth. But my guest today is also talking about, you know, how far are you from the people who made your food and the people who are all throughout the food chain, you know, working to market it, to grow the, you know, feed for the animals and so forth. And I think it's a really interesting perspective to look at the food system. So he is actually a professor of sociology and the associate dean for research at the College of Liberal Arts at Colorado State University. And he's also the author of The Real Cost of Cheap Food, The Sociology of Food and Agriculture. So his book that we're talking about today, it's his most recent book. It's called No One Eats Alone, Food as a Social Enterprise. And we're very pleased to welcome Michael S. Carolyn on the air. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Thanks for having me. It's I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah. I'm really excited by, discovering this different, I guess, perspective. A lot of people apply a more, science, have a lot of farming background that can speak to the issues about our current food system or foodscape, as you say, or food landscape. Is that your preferred term that you mentioned?
I do like using the term foodscape for reasons that we can, if there's time, we can certainly talk about. Yes.
Okay, but is the sort of general gist that we aren't connecting the dots between the people who work in all facets of the food industry enough? Sort of the main sort of thrust that takes this that you take in this book.
Yeah, that's one of the thrusts, at least. I guess it kind of plays on even the title to some degree, No One Eats Alone, because, of course, that's what is often said, is that one of the problems is that we do eat alone. And I want to kind of play off of that to tell a story about how populated our foodscape is, which just goes beyond knowing your farmer. I mean, that's something we hear all the time.
Know thy farmer,
But even if we were to follow a food back all the way to the farmer, that misses a whole landscape of people that could be involved. For instance, just one really quick example that I sometimes like to give is that I spent some time interviewing a gentleman in China who was managing an industrial vitamin plant in China. And, as you may or may not know, that the federal law in the United States, as well as in Canada and UK and other places, require foods like milk and bread to be fortified with, among other things, vitamin D. And here was a chemical plant that manufactures the great majority of the vitamin D for the entire world that goes into fortifying our foods. And so, on one hand, we talk about knowing your farmer, but, in some respects, we should also have a slogan that says something like, know your industrialized vitamin D manufacturer, too, but that's not terribly sexy. But there's all these other people that go into making what our food is, and just knowing the farmer, traceability back to a farm, it misses a whole bunch.
Yeah. I was thinking, I was going to make a joke about how we're sort of trying to play 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon with our bacon sometimes. And
I love that.
Sometimes it works, sometimes you can't. But, you're leaving out all these other facets of food. And that's really interesting. At the same time, you note that there's all these additives, enriched, enriched wheat flour now has these chemists who are making, who knows what, the vitamin D from milk and so forth. And, you know, there's lobbyists involved. There's so many roles in the food scape. I think it's really interesting you point out in the beginning, near the beginning of the book, that at the same time we have so many, I guess, producers or parts of the production chain, we are also reducing the number of foods that we actually eat in the society down to like something like 10 crops.
Right.
And that's
yes,
a shrinkage that is unusual. You wouldn't think that that would go hand in hand. We used to eat a lot more stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that has not only implications for, you know, diet and biological diversity, but, you know, as a social scientist, too, I like to remind people when I talk about things like biological diversity that you can't talk about biological diversity without talking about cultural diversity as well, because, you know, unless there's people that actually have a desire to want to eat those types of foods that require, say, blue corn, for instance, mm-hmm. There's no reason for producers to produce blue corn, and no reason for grocers to supply it. And so this cultural element about our tastes and about how we know to prepare these foods, this is all, you know, has to be wrapped into this conversation when it comes to biological diversity and dietary diversity, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talk a lot about the success stories, I think, sometimes of, reintroducing heritage or heirloom tomatoes. But for all those, you know, newly re-embraced eggplants and so forth, there's a lot of things that people just don't want to eat because of it fell out of fashion or who knows what. It's very much a part of, you know, each culture. Like you mentioned, you know, some countries don't want to eat, I don't know. Actually, there's a great example in your book. You mentioned the issue of turkey tails.
Yes.
And we were, this is fascinating. I didn't realize that America was dumping so many turkey tails on Samoa because we were producing this, you know, this is like a byproduct of making turkey. We're making a lot of turkeys and each turkey has a tail, which is also called like the Pope's nose or something else. And we don't really like it. It's not like, it's just something we don't really like as a culture.
Right.
And so what happened then? What did we do with it?
Right. Yeah. Well, so I have this quote in my book that starts off that section, and it's a producer that talks about how, and I've heard this term as well, but when we talk about livestock production, we're really talking about the maximization of assholes per acre, and that's only to play upon this idea that when you
that's
increase
funny.
The output of an animal or a specific
the
cut
yield.
Of an animal,
mm-hmm.
especially, right, we talk about, for instance, in the context of health, about how we need to eat more white meat or something like that, but mm-hmm. that forgets that an animal produces lots of different types of meat, white, dark, tails, noses, rear ends, etc. And so then we have these questions about what do you do with all this other stuff that's produced when you have this living organism that has all these parts to it that you need to find a market for. And so you're absolutely right. This is a product of us wanting to industrialize and produce more to satisfy mm-hmm. our needs in the West, but it has this after effect of you have all these other parts that you have to then deal with and create commodity chains as a result of. And the other thing I like about the turkey tail example too, it's an example of how you have a food that was introduced into a culture a couple generations ago now in the
Samoa.
50s and
mm-hmm.
60s, which has become by folks there would be defined as a part of their national cuisine. When you talk to Samoans about what's a traditional Samoan dish, and I mentioned this in the book too, that many of them would mention a turkey tail and a Budweiser. And of course, you know, we would realize that those aren't Samoan dishes. Those are kind of iconic, well, at least a Budweiser is an iconic dish, and yet it's been embraced by folks there. And so it does bring up these interesting questions of what really does it mean to have a national cuisine, or how does something become mm-hmm. go from being foreign to being something that's intimately embraced by a culture, those are really interesting sociological questions as well. A lot of it boils down to, and I mentioned this in the book too, this notion of conviviality, how food needs to be convivial for it to be kind of adopted and to be embraced. And that's exactly what these turkey tails are. These are eaten in moments of relaxation with others, same with a Budweiser. And when you have food that's consumed in that matter, people are more likely to like it.
Or attach like good feelings to it, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's sometimes a piece that we need to think about, too, when you're thinking about alternative foods, is that, you know, you just can't give kids, say, a quarter when you talk about incentivizing, say, lunch programs to get kids to eat more fruits and vegetables, but you have to figure out ways to make that type of food more cool and more social. You know, Coca-Cola came up with the ubiquitous strategy 50 years ago, and that's based on this idea that they wanted to get a Coke in somebody's hands whenever they were having a good time, and that's how right. Coke became associated with the with America's pastime.
So, like ball games, you know, theaters, maybe going to movie theaters, and you had this great example of how they managed to get Coca-Cola into World War II. Rations, because it was like an alternative to, I don't know, it was something that's not alcoholic and people wanted.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It was non-alcoholic, had some caffeine, it didn't hinder military readiness. Mm-hmm. And so Coke had this great deal with the American government, essentially, where they made sure that they were able to get Coca-Cola in the GI's hands for a nickel, realizing that it wouldn't be wildly profitable for the company.
No,
but then you have... You know, all these men and women coming back, and sure enough, they want a Coke then.
Because they're so sort of like nostalgic for a taste of home, and then they get this Coke, and then they have this positive association with it maybe for the rest of their life.
Exactly, yeah. As does everybody. Then the countries that were freed by the Allied powers, they associated with democracy and freedom with the Coca-Cola because they're the gentlemen and women that were there fighting on behalf of them were drinking that, and so it was an incredible, brilliant campaign by Coca-Cola executives. Yes.
So I had one thought I wanted to get back to about the turkey tails in Samoa and them adopting it as one of their like national, you know, dishes. And this is something that, you know, a very successful project, I guess, then, or campaign, you know, to get rid of turkey tails. It definitely works. So what is, you know, is there any harm in that, you know, in that sort of exchange? Okay, they now love turkey tails, and we didn't want it. So win-win, right? But actually, you mentioned that nowadays, because turkey tails were so cheap, it's more it's cheaper than some of their own locally or domestically grown foods. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah, that's
a problem.
Exactly part of the reason why they were adopted so widely is because and they're cheaper than some of their traditional foods, but then also meat has a particular iconic status to it as well. And so it's certainly cheaper than what we would consider to be prime cuts, but it was an affordable meat that had a certain status too. So there was a status issue that came along with it and helped propel its adoption too in that respect.
Mm, but is there any other problem that you see with that kind of, global trade-off?
Well, I don't see a problem with the global trade per se. It's just what are the trade-offs, if you will, when it comes to global trade? And so when it comes to issues of, say, reducing dietary preferences around the world and tastes around the world, that has consequences, of course, most obviously, perhaps, is from a biological diversity standpoint and a cultural diversity standpoint. But then eventually down the road, turkey tails are not, say, the staple like rice is in some countries. But if you were to take and substitute turkey tails for rice, I don't talk much about rice in the book, but I do actually in the other book that you mentioned, The Real Cost of Cheap Food. Mm-hmm. You know, when you start having countries become dependent upon other countries for their staple foods, that's all well and good when those staple foods are traded at a global market and they're affordable. You know, when you're dealing with an age of peak water and peak oil and peak everything else, there are some real concerns about what that dependence that we create in the 20th century is going to translate into in the 21st century when we start having the price of oil and other things creeping up and potentially having negative consequences in terms of what used to be affordable cheap food to what might be affordable or available in the future. And then once those affordable foods dry up, you have a country that no longer has the capacity, the infrastructure, even the knowledge to be able to produce the domestic foods that they used to produce generations generations go. So it's you have to take a kind of a long view and think about issues of resiliency and other things like that when you're talking about these things, as opposed to an X moment in time. Mm. Oh, this is more expensive, or this is more affordable right now than food X, Y, and Z. I think it's important to think about it in a kind of a larger context.
Wow. Yeah, my head just exploded just then, but it's very complicated. Michael, we're just going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude, and we'll be right back to add more.
Hey, this is Cynthia, host of Primary Food, here with Anna Bonengel, a registered dietitian with Eat With Zest, eatwithzest.com, and we are here to talk about Bob's Red Mill and superfoods. So, Anna, what is a superfood anyway?
One way to think about it is, if you think of foods along a spectrum, there are a few foods with fewer nutrients, and then there are foods that are packed rich with nutrients and antioxidants. And so superfoods are those that are on the furthest on the scale in terms of having the most nutrients and antioxidants.
Which foods are considered superfoods?
Some are super well known, like blueberries, kale, salmon. But now people are also going nuts over lesser known foods like goji berries, acai, flax, and chia seeds. And a really popular one now is black garlic.
So if I'm trying to eat better, should I go on a strictly superfood diet?
Well, you know, superfoods are, of course, great, and I will say the more you eat, the better. However, eating only superfoods would make you deprived of essential nutrients from nourishing food groups like whole grains.
Okay, got it. Well, that's great, because our sponsor at HRN, Bob's Red Mill, produces a lot of delicious whole grain products.
You know, to be honest, I'm a huge Bob's Red Mill fan. I love a lot of the whole grains that they provide, but I particularly love they've come out with a blueberry hazelnut oatmeal cup that is totally delicious. It's got classic superfoods like blueberries, but also some of the more trendy ones like flax and chia seeds. It's a really nice mix of trend and tradition.
Bob's Red Mill doesn't chase fads. They just keep working hard to offer as many delicious whole grain and organic food options as possible in an endless commitment to good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
All right, we're back chatting more with Michael S. Carolyn. His latest book is called No One Eats Alone, Food as a Social Enterprise, and there are so many topics to talk about in this book. But you briefly mentioned, you know, the title as an inspiration, and you know, because a lot of people eat alone nowadays, but you said that was a problem, you know, eating at your desks, you know, in solitary without this like convivial feel that can lead to such great associations with food. So why did you get inspired by that sort of phenomenon of eating alone?
Well, part of it is some things that have just happened within the last few years in our country here, and you're kind of seeing these phenomena happening in other kind of affluent countries too, and that's this idea of, sometimes we refer to it as kind of how polarized we've become as a society, and I kind of like the term social distance. I think you might have even used that term too, social distance. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we conflate spatial distance, you know, how close we are to where food has been produced under the kind of the guise of local food. And we assume that also means that we're reducing our social distance with other people that populate our foodscape. And, you know, at one extreme, I visited a gated community in Atlanta that had a farmer's market, and here you have arguably local food, but with, you know, vast spatial or vast social distance, where, you know, unless you were of an individual who lived in that gated community, you didn't have access to that particular foodscape. So it makes me interested about the kind of the convivial aspect of food is based upon some of the research that I've done and how some of these alternative foodscapes actually can help reduce some of that social distance, can actually bring people from different socioeconomic backgrounds together and create what I talk about in the book as empathy, in a sense, because it certainly seems like, giving the visceral nature of how we talk to one another today and the political climate of today, never in my lifetime, at least, have I lived in a world where it seems like there's us's and there's them's, and that really concerns me. And I see food as maybe one way in which we can create some spaces that reduce some of that us-ing and them-ing and get us to talk to one another and work alongside one another and get to a place where we might actually be, heaven forbid, comfortable about eating at the same table with somebody that maybe has from a different religion or whose skin color is different than our own. And I find that hopeful when I talk about food in kind of that way.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, when you think of like a pig farmer, and you're totally divorced from anyone in that field or that industry, versus like when that person might happen to be your neighbor or somebody who you're friends of friends with. You know, it's a really different feel. It's empathy. So how do we achieve that in today's day and age when everything is so fragmented and, you know, there's like massive feedlot situations and instead of like smaller farms?
Right. Well, we certainly have to do it intentionally because, you know, even the alternative food movement folks don't always get it right. Because if you were to locate, whether it's a farmer's market or community supported agriculture in a place where it's absolutely impossible for someone from a lower socioeconomic background or a food desert neighborhood to be able to access those spaces.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You have to think about these things intentionally. They just can't happen. There's no such thing. I don't believe that good food is inherently better, or I'm sorry, I don't believe local food is inherently better. You have to think strategically when you're doing local food to make it better. It just doesn't happen on its own.
Mm. All right. So examining this, the breaking down of distance between people, you mentioned, you know, in chapter 6 called Slow Food to Connectivity. You know, you travel to a lot of folks who are making this food. And what kind of, there's like a lot of interesting, you know, encounters that you have here with, folks that are making food, but also you're a little critical of the slow food movement and how, you know, the initial ideas were well-meaning, but, you know, people aren't really enjoying, the food companies that, make the food. You know, there's no, like, connectivity between the slow food movement and a lot of the people who make the food. In fact, there's sometimes, you know, a little bit of a agitation between the two. So how do we, like, break down the walls between, you know, the slow food and the rest of food production?
Right. Yeah, well, my concern when it comes to slow food is that unless you can take an approach to the problem with a big picture, it begins to kind of feel like a whack-a-mole sort of problem in that, you know, if I were to slow down to be able to spend the 2 or 3 hours to make some traditional ethnic dish or cuisine that's meaningful to me and culturally meaningful to people, you know, unless you change a broader context, then I'm going to have to speed up probably some other aspect of my life in order for me to allow me to slow down for those 2 or 3 minutes of my life. And so I do worry that sometimes it becomes too myopically focused on the actual act of preparation without thinking about this other context of why our lives are so sped up to begin with and how we can create some larger changes so that we're doing kind of everything more slowly. Because on the same respects, industrial big food is playing on this notion of being able to slow down too, because you look at the slogans, you deserve a break today, all these things that are being marketed. In some respects, I've talked to execs about this. You know, they think they're selling slow food too, about how you need a reprieve, how you need to take 60 minutes out of your life and relax and let them cook their food for you. You know, come here, we're everybody's family, Olive Garden's old slogan. And so I sometimes don't think slow food's even critical enough. And not thinking systemically enough either, and it does the movement a disservice to some degree, because then it opens them up for these critiques of whack-a-mole and other things like that.
Yeah. So how can we, like, you know, someone who's not maybe a researcher or actively working in food, how can we, you know, be a better food citizen, or like how can we help out in any way?
Yeah, that is definitely the $10,000 question. And I guess to some degree, it comes back to why I like talking about foodscapes too, because while we like the term food system now is starting to become more used, I hear people in USDA and politicians even use it. But my concern with the notion of a food system is that it tends to be conflated with a commodity chain where you have You have farmers, you have processors, you have retailers, and you have the consumer.
So a big food system. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But at the end, there's the consumer, and I don't think of myself as just a consumer. We are more than just people that are cost maximizers. You know, we love, we have interest, we care about things, we do things that are irrational. And my worry also with the notion of consumer is that it starts to reduce democracy to this idea that you can just vote with your dollar. And of course, any sort of democracy where the number of votes you get hinges on how much money you have is problematic too, but it also minimizes and reduces our capacity to think about social change as well. And so I really try to remind people that we're not just consumers. We certainly should try to vote with our dollar, but we should also vote with our voices and become politically active in other ways, just beyond being politically active in the marketplace. Because to get back to the point you mentioned earlier, too, about how the number of foods that we're eating is shrinking, you know, when your choice is literally between Coke and Pepsi in some cases, you know, if you're choosing between a GMO-free Salitas potato chip or a MSG-free Doritos potato chip, you know, they're both made by Pepsi. And so really, what choice is that? And so to be able to generate real choices, I think we need to step outside the marketplace sometimes and think about working together and collaboratively and forming some of these alternative foodscapes. And I try to document a lot of examples in the book of how people have gotten together successfully working outside of markets to create foodscapes that are accommodating to people of all socioeconomic backgrounds and all cultures, and just try to learn from examples of that has happened across the world.
Yeah. Michael, you briefly mentioned, I forget what we were talking about, but, you know, school cafeteria food choices. And, you know, if kids don't like vegetables, you know, like how do you associate good feelings around this, you know, and it made me think of, you know, recently the new agriculture secretary relaxed some of the standards in school food lunches. I'm not sure if you heard about that. Like at first they had to, you know, with the Obama era, they tried to make them have more vegetables in every school cafeteria.
Right.
And now they're kind of laxing up on that a bit because the kids didn't like them, the vegetables. You know, so much effort has been put into making kids like vegetables. I wonder how, if we were to take a page from Coca-Cola, like how we could create that, you know, better. Do you have any thoughts on some ways to solve that?
Well, it's just there is no silver bullet when it comes to all of those things. I love the idea of expanding the food choices for our children under the Obama administration. But to be fair, what we did is we spent millions of dollars to just increase food waste. I mean, honestly, that's kind of what happened.
Right.
You just can't make food accessible and think that if you build it, they will come. You have to take steps then to make them want to come and not make it feel like they're being forced to either.
Yeah.
And so, to take a page from Coca-Cola, we do need to think about how we can make food more convivial. They don't have time to talk about what that actually means, but just thinking that you can force kids to do that isn't going to work because they're going to grow up to resent it and then not want to eat it when they finally have the freedom to choose for themselves. And the incentivizing programs, you know, where there have been instances where they've been giving kids a quarter to take their and put it on their plate, it doesn't mean they eat it or it doesn't mean they eat all of it, and it certainly doesn't mean they necessarily enjoy it, because when those incentives go away, their behaviors, which is often a problem with incentives, once you remove an incentive, the behavior tends to resort back to what happened in the past. So we do need to think about how we can make food, as I said before, cool, how to make it fun, and we don't seem to be doing a very good job with that. We're focusing so much on things like nutritional literacy, but I've never met anybody who doesn't know that fresh fruits and vegetables are not good for them, and yet look at what they eat. I mean, I could say the same for myself. I know what a perfectly healthy diet is, but as my wife would tell you, it doesn't always look like what I put in my mouth either. So,
it's a good, you know, it's interesting to think about, and you know, hopefully with this perspectives, we'll get better at understanding those challenges. I guess we're just about out of time, but Michael, you've been a great guest, and I'm just curious, what do you hope, you know, readers take away from this book most?
Well, you already touched on one, just that our food escape is populated in ways that we often don't think about. But then also the other thing that I think my book is different from some of the other food writers out there is that I try to actually bring in some of the expertise from social scientists and psychological scientists to talk about what does it mean to change behaviors, how do we do, what do we know about behavioral change, and just try to glean some insights from that literature. So as opposed to making this more of just kind of a journalistic account, I'm trying to bring some of my own expertise to bear to help us understand how we might be able to get people to change their behaviors in ways that doesn't feel like the nanny state's forcing them to, or in ways that may make them feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Really good lessons to learn. And your book has so many fascinating research and topics and just really amazing work that you've done to write this book. I can't thank you enough for joining us today, Michael.
Well, I've enjoyed this talk a lot, and thank you for your praise. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, check out No One Eats Alone, Food as Social Enterprise, and we'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Fresh Pickings is a podcast by Heritage Radio Network presented by Bob's Red Mill. Love learning about food? Get more superfood for your brain with the featured podcast miniseries, Fresh Pickings. Go to bobsredmill.com/freshpickings.
If I offered you a bag of Nooch or a sprinkle of hippie dust, would you take it? If you're a pizza-loving vegan, you probably would. Today on Fresh Pickings, nutritional yeast and its various street names. What it is and why you should be putting it on your popcorn next time you go to the movies. Today I'll chat with Dave Arnold, co-host of Cooking Issues here on HRN, about what nutritional yeast actually is and what it is not. Then VLGL blogger Elizabeth Taylor is back to give us a recipe that uses nutritional yeast and, for a bonus, chickpea flour. I'm your host, Kat Johnson. Thanks for joining us. So when I think of an every food topping, I'm usually thinking about Parm, Parmesan cheese, Parmesan on pizza, on pasta, on a crunchy Caesar salad, even on my eggs in the morning. Or I might be thinking about ketchup, because some people put ketchup on all of those things too. But what if cheese isn't your thing? Or we can all agree that ketchup on salad is pretty gross. Or what if it's just time to change things up a bit? Now, don't get me wrong, Parmesan will never go out of style, and ketchup and fries belong together. But variety is the spice of life. So getting in on nutritional yeast is a great way to add some spice and umami to your life.
So variety, that's great and all, and I know what yeast is, but what is nutritional yeast? It doesn't sound very food-like.
This is David, our engineer, and that's a great question, David. So nutritional yeast is sort of like vegan cheese. It goes great on popcorn, and you can make vegan mac and cheese with it, but it's flaky. The folks over at Bon Appetit magazine called it nature's Cheeto dust, but unlike Cheetos, this is actually good for you.
That sounds intriguing. Still not sure what it is, though.
Okay, if you can't be convinced by my flaky umami cheese-like goodness description and that it goes on everything, then I'm going to have to get an expert to weigh in. I'm all about flavor, but not so much about specifics. So I'm going to check in with Dave Arnold of Cooking Issues to find out more.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold of Cooking Issues, and I have a lot to say about nutritional yeast, and that goes way beyond Kat's accurate and tantalizing but pretty vague description.
Okay, great. I needed someone to step in here. Thanks, Dave. Can you please explain what this stuff actually is?
All right. Despite the strange name, it's definitely food. So nutritional yeast is the deactivated, you know, dead, they've killed it, form of Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Now, that's basically the same yeast that you would use to make bread, to make beer. So it's definitely common. It's not some weird, like, funky thing. It's like almost all the good things we like to eat or drink it's involved with. Not almost, but, you know, a lot of the good things we like to eat or drink are involved with it. So the way it's produced is first you culture to grow it in a warm, sweet medium the same way that they would do when they're making beer or as a first start to whiskey. Then after it grows, they kill it, basically, and dry it out. And you could use it that way.
So is it nutritious?
Well, if you believe in nutrition as a form of measuring foodstuffs rather than just deliciousness, then yes. I mean, remember, it's a complete organism. So it's got, you know, a lot of protein. So a quarter cup of it, which is quite a bit, actually, a quarter cup of yeast. But that's 8 grams of protein, 3 grams of fiber, and 5 grams of carbohydrates. That's off the back of the package. I don't know that stuff off the top of my head. It has lots of micronutrients like thiamine, niacin, riboflavin, B6, B12, zinc, folate. You know, so it's also something good for, you know, vegans who can't get a lot of those things out of because they're not getting a animal-based diets or dairy-based diets. So it's good to get those things that are sometimes hard to get out of straight plant foods.
So why does it taste savory and meaty?
Well, yeast, and so, like, there's a bunch of different kinds of yeast, and yeast is actually one of the things that's used in commercial foods to provide meaty taste. Different, but, you know, it's broken down to certain degrees. So the protein in yeast, once it's, like, autolyzed or broken up, and a lot of yeast, after it grows and starts dying, will self-autolyze, right? So it can produce a wide variety of flavors, but protein breakdown products in particular from yeast can produce meaty aroma, meaty flavors, rather.
Elizabeth Taylor, the creator of food blog VLGL.cooking. Today I have a recipe that uses not just one, but two of my favorite Bob's Red Mill products, chickpea flour and, of course, nutritional yeast.
I'm so excited to have Elizabeth Taylor back to share another recipe with us. Elizabeth runs the blog VLGL.cooking, which is her collection of vegan low glycemic load culinary creations. In the last episode, Elizabeth explained the VLGL eating philosophy and gave us a killer recipe for grain-free granola. Let's see what she brought today. So, Elizabeth, Bob's Red Mill makes a lot of products that fit into the VLGL philosophy, don't they?
They sure do, Kat. In addition to being low glycemic, meaning that it won't cause a spike in blood sugar, chickpea flour is packed with plant-based protein, iron, selenium, and folate. Chickpea flour has a mild, earthy flavor, and I love to use it for all kinds of savory dishes like this chickpea flour omelet recipe. When you mix chickpea flour with water, spices, and baking soda and heat this mixture in a lightly oiled pan, it transforms into a hearty dish that can be enjoyed at any time of the day. These chickpea flour omelets are denser and more bread-like than an egg omelet, yet richer and sturdier than a crepe. They're great with savory veggies, and my recipe uses kale and juicy grilled tomatoes with chipotle powder.
That sounds really delicious. So how are you using the nutritional yeast in this recipe?
Nutritional yeast is one of my go-to seasonings. It brings true savory magic to vegan food. In this recipe, I use it to season the chickpea flour omelet for an umami flavor.
Thanks so much to Dave Arnold for the yeasty science lesson and to Elizabeth Taylor for sharing her tips for using nutritional yeast. You can find her recipe for the chickpea flour omelet with chipotle grilled tomatoes at bobsredmill.com/freshpickings. Well, that's just about everything you could want to know about nutritional yeast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to check out our other episodes of Fresh Pickings and learn more about Bob's Red Mill's favorite ingredients, including some delicious recipes and great coupon offers, by going to bobsredmill.com/freshpickings. Bob's Red Mill believes in good food for all. For Heritage Radio Network, I'm your host, Kat Johnson. Thanks for joining us.